My name is Dr. Chris Jenkins, and I am the CEO of the Orianne Society and the host of the Snake Talk podcast, the podcast where you learn about nature's most feared, maligned, and persecuted animals. I invite you to listen to this conversation, and maybe you'll find that what you perceive as fear is actually rooted in a deep fascination. Welcome to the Snake Talk Podcast. I am excited about today's conversation. I am here with Dr. Whitney Robles. I've never met her. This is the first time I've talked to her, but everything that I've read just points me to her being a very fascinating person, and I'm excited to learn more. She can correct me if I'm wrong, but she kind of works at somewhat of the intersection of history and nature, and has written quite a bit about snakes in particular, as well as many other things. So I'm excited to just kind of learn about how she ended up in this somewhat unique space. We'll dive a little deeper into some of her snake experiences and, you know, her research and writing around snakes. And we'll talk about some of her other work and writing as well. So I'm pretty excited. Welcome to the podcast, Whitney. How are you doing today?
Hey, Chris. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to start all of my episodes and figure out where it all began. So you obviously, you know, or have kind of a deep interest in nature. I mentioned history as well, but I know you have an interest in snakes and reptiles, amphibians in general. Like, how did that all start for you? Even just an interest in reptiles and amphibians is a pretty rare thing if we look at society as a whole. So is that something that happened when you were young, something that you kind of came to later in life? How'd that come about for you?
Well, probably like a lot of your guests, it did start in childhood. I had this nickname amongst the neighborhood moms. I was known as the Queen of Disgust, and I had a kind of rotating cast of pets. I had leopard geckos and rainforest frogs. I don't know if they were poison dart frogs or what species. Tortoises. I had a grass lizard. Now I've kind of learned more about all of the problems with the exotic pet trade, but certainly as an elementary school kid, was just in love with these things. I also had a llama, although not a creepy crawly, but kind of a non-standard pet for a kid. And the one thing I was forbidden from having was snakes. My mom put her foot down there, and so that just kind of made them more interesting and appealing to me. And I was also always fascinated by how fearful people were of snakes. So we had a next door neighbor who was very afraid of snakes, and they found a garter snake in a bush. And so, you know, they were an adult. I was maybe 6 or 7, and they called me over and asked if I could locate it, remove it off of their property. And I was really excited to get to do this. And then I looked under the bush and my heart sank because it was just a striped bungee cord. It was not even a snake, but it sort of impressed upon me how quick people are to judge snakes and fear them and malign them. And it was fascinating to me because it sat in contrast to everything that I felt about snakes and other weird animals.
So you're sitting in North Carolina today, and we'll get to that, how you ended up there. Is that also where you grew up, where you had this snake, in air quotes, experience as a child?
I actually grew up in Northern Illinois, so not Chicago. Everyone always thinks that, but culturally more like Southern Wisconsin, a very rural area, about a 3,000-person corn town kind of near the prairie. So we had some snakes, not quite the wealth of snakes that we have here in North Carolina, but not something that I got to see all that often, which again, just sort of turned them into this forbidden fruit for me.
Yeah. How did you, so you're a child and you have this interest in snakes growing up in a rural area. How did you, like, when did it hit you that, you know, kind of the history component? Did you also have that interest as a child, or is that something that hit you kind of later in life?
I would say that hit later in college. I got my undergraduate degree at Yale in American Studies, but you could sort of design your own concentration. And so I took a class with late professor Linda Peterson, who was incredible. It was a sort of an American nature writing class. And that's when I first got introduced to the idea that you could study the history of how people have thought about nature and written about nature. There's such wonderful nature writing out there. And so I ended up writing a senior thesis about something called the Nature Fakers Controversy, which it was seemingly this kind of obscure literary debate, but actually Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president at the time, he had to step in. But it was basically a debate about the acceptability of anthropomorphism and sentimentality when you were writing about animals. So after I graduated college, you know, I continued to be interested in natural history. And I was really lucky to get my first job out of college at the American Museum of Natural History. So I was first working on their exhibition team. I was working on an exhibition about dinosaur biology. And then I got a permanent position in their communications wing, where I was an editorial assistant, but essentially I was a science writer. And so I was interviewing all of the museum scientists. I was getting to go behind the scenes of collections, see specimens, talk to them about their research and fieldwork that they were doing in all of these different locations. And so that was an amazing job. I ended up moving to California because my husband, well, now husband, then he was my boyfriend, was in law school at the time. And we were sort of tired of these 6-hour coast-to-coast flights once a month. And so I started working in a laboratory at Caltech. You could think of it as a global health laboratory, but it was housed in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering. But it was a really interdisciplinary, cool lab. We had microbiologists. We had obviously chemists, engineers. We had physicists. There were people doing computational models. There were people, you know, doing things like literally with microbes on petri dishes. And I got to see how the sausage of science was made in this one particular context. And I got to see sort of inside academia in a way that was very different from what it's like for a college student to just sort of observe your professors. And that's eventually what set me on the path to graduate school. And I really approached my PhD as a 5 to 7 year writing fellowship, since my dissertation ended up becoming my first book.
Ah, okay. I want to get to that, to the graduate school chapter. But before we do that, I want to go back to Yale for just a second. And so when you were, you know, when you were coming out of high school and deciding where to go to school, obviously Yale is strong in you know, literature and history, but it's also pretty strong in the sciences. You know, I mean, their forestry school, for example, is one of the top forestry schools in the country. So what I'm curious about is, what drove you to do your undergrad at Yale? Was it just because it's Yale, or did you go there for the literature? Did you go there for the science? What was it that drove you to go there?
You know, it's funny. I grew up in this kind of secluded, small Midwestern town. So every other college I applied to was in Illinois, except Yale was the one Ivy League where you only had to submit the ACT. So I've never taken the SATs. It's not something that any student at my high school ever did. It's just not part of the culture there. Midwestern schools at the time were more ACT focused. So it was kind of arbitrary that Yale was just the one that would sort of let me apply. And when I got in, it was kind of a no-brainer. It just seemed like it would, you know, take me to places I had never been exposed to before. But once I sort of got in the saddle there, I majored in a humanities major, but I was in love with so many of the science classes I took. I got to take a ornithology class with Rick Prum, who's this really famous ornithologist. So that was kind of just one of the experiences that made me want to try to marry the humanities and the sciences.
Okay, great. So you finish at Yale, and you said you took that first job, which you know, you're continuing that marriage of disciplines, if you will, and then you went on to graduate school. You mentioned your PhD, but did you do a master's in between the PhD, or did you go straight from your bachelor's to the PhD?
I got a master's as part of my PhD program is how it was structured. Although, so my PhD is in American studies, and we can talk about what that is. But my actual master's is in history. But I didn't do sort of a terminal master's before that. It was just folded into this PhD program.
Gotcha. And that was at Harvard. Is that right?
Yep.
Excellent. So you stayed in the Ivies, you stayed in New England, and, so let's talk a little bit about your dissertation, which you mentioned, you know, was essentially this almost like a long writing retreat, if you will, where you wrote your first book. So talk about that first book and you know, kind of what it was about, and maybe a little bit about your process as writing a book as a dissertation.
Yeah. So both the dissertation and the book are titled Curious Species, How Animals Made Natural History. And it looks at the 18th century, which is essentially the era when natural history as a discipline is founded. So this is the age of Linnaeus. This is the age when something like modern museums come into being, modern natural history museums. And a lot of scholars had looked at the 18th century because it is such an important moment in the history of science. But I wanted to tell the story of the birth of natural history from animals' perspective, in a sense, to kind of flip the structure of the narrative rather than looking just at the people who were studying these animals, think about how the animals themselves had a kind of active impact on the science. And so in terms of the format, it goes through four different animals. It starts with corals, then there's a section on rattlesnakes, there's a section on fish, and one on raccoons. Everyone loves raccoons. And it alternates within each animal. I start with a chapter about that animal's influence on 18th century natural history, not in an anthropomorphic way, but sort of as the protagonist, so to speak. And then it's followed by a present day chapter written in the first person where I go to encounter that animal or its descendants, essentially, somewhere in the world today. So with corals, for example, I was really fortunate to get funding to go to the Great Barrier Reef and find this reef that is called Endeavour Reef because it nearly took down Captain Cook's first voyage in 1770, and his ship for that voyage was called the Endeavour. And so in that chapter, for example, I think about this creature that was seen as such a menace in the 18th century because ships had to learn how to avoid coral reefs, is now seen as a damsel in distress, right? This reef that I visited is severely bleached. So I look at themes like climate change, habitat loss, how these sort of affect the presence and futures of these animals today. Mm-hmm.
Let's stick with the corals for a second. We'll stay away from the rattlesnakes for a minute because we're going to go into that in depth. But so you're talking about flipping the coin, however you want to term it, but looking at how the animals kind of directed natural history. You know, when we think about the natural history and you know, we think about people like down here in the South, like William Bartram, or, you know, we even think about like Lewis and Clark, some of their first expeditions into the West. But I love that concept, how animals, or not even animals per se, but living, other organisms influenced it. And so with the coral, is one of the kind of like the thesis or the concept there that, like, because coral was such an important thing to people back then, you already mentioned how significant it could be, almost stopping one of these famous explorers that we think about, that by like an organism's impact on our world, it helped drive us to learn more about those things. And it, you know, in a particular time period, is that kind of the thesis? I'm not trying to summarize the whole book, but it's just kind of an interesting concept.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So on the kind of larger scale, corals literally kind of demarcate the path of empire in the 18th century with the formation of reefs. But if we look at the really small scale, corals also become this natural history fascination, because it wasn't until the middle of the 18th century that it was sort of becoming accepted to acknowledge that corals were animals instead of plants. Because a coral polyp, for those who don't know, the coral reef, so it's essentially limestone, is laid down by all of these tiny, tiny animals that look like a mini sea anemone called coral polyps, or it's like an upside down jellyfish. And they look like flowers to some, right? And so there was a big debate in the 18th century about what these were. There was a term, zoophytes, which kind of shows the mixed nature of these beings. And so it's both kind of the small story of how people came to encounter these polyps within the ocean, and then had this large debate back in Europe about what the nature of an animal was, because they also do some plant-like things, right? They regenerate if you cut them in half, for example. They were also looking at freshwater hydras, which are kind of, you know, just a freshwater version of coral polyps, more or less. And they were doing all sorts of experiments with cutting and regeneration, and the kind of penchant for immortality that these animals have, both in that they, on a cellular level, resist aging, but because you can also just continue to kind of chop them up and they reproduce. So there's a debate about what animals even are and sort of what they're capable of. But one more thing I'll say is that there is this widespread idea in 18th century natural history of the concept of the great chain of being. And this goes back to antiquity, Aristotle and the like, but it sees its kind of zenith in the 18th century. And within that framework, everything is sort of arranged. You can think of it as a ladder. So you've got inanimate matter on the bottom, and then you've got plants, the vegetable kingdom, then you've got animals, then humans, and then in some versions of this chain, you've got God and angels on the top. And so at the interface between the plant and animal worlds, that's sort of where polyps were placed. And so it's quite unsettling to scientists within this hierarchical way of thinking about the world to realize that the lowliest animal within this system is the one that's also bringing down these ships.
Okay. Let's. I really want to talk about the rattlesnakes, but we'll circle back to that in a minute, because I want to finish your story in terms of where you've been and how you ended up in North Carolina. But before we do that, since we mentioned the book, I will just say I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to read it. And I'll put a link in the show notes so the audience can, can link to where to buy that. Where do you think the best place for the audience to find the book and purchase it would be?
You know, if they're able to find it in a local independent bookstore, that's always the best, or bookshop.org can help with that. It's also available on the publisher's website, that's Yale University Press's website, and other outlets like Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It was out of stock at one point, but it should be there soon, if not now.
Great. I'll link the Yale website. That'll probably be the best one for these purposes. But So again, we'll come back to the book, and we'll come back to rattlesnakes in particular. But before we do that, you finished your PhD at Harvard. When did you finish your time at Harvard?
That was in 2019.
In 2019. And then where did you end up going from there? Because I believe there was one stop before you found your way to the South here.
Yeah, after I graduated Harvard, I was very fortunate to get a 3-year postdoc at Dartmouth College in something called the Society of Fellows. And so that really gave me the space to turn this dissertation into a book, because there was still a lot of research and writing that remained after that. The dissertation did not have so much of an emphasis on the present. And because I was in New Hampshire, I'm sure we'll get to this, but that's actually how I got to get the present day story of the rattlesnake narrative into this book, was by being in New Hampshire, of all places. And then I was at Dartmouth for another year after that. After being in the Society of Fellows, I was also a lecturer in the Department of History.
Okay. Yeah, so I was going to ask about the process of the book when we get back to the book. I was going to ask about the process of going from a dissertation to a book, but let's talk a little bit about that. So the PhD is essentially to write the book, but it sounds like the dissertation was more, you know, that same structure that you described with the, you know, the four different examples, species, but it was much more focused on the history there and not the contemporary. And so just speak a little bit, if you would, what was that process like, going from writing a dissertation, I'm assuming somewhat in the format of a book, but then actually writing the book. And I'm very curious what, you know, obviously you realized at some point that putting that contemporary component to each of those stories was important. You know, why didn't you include that in the dissertation? How did you make the decision to go to Dartmouth and you know, build the book out from the dissertation?
Yeah, so I think a lot of folks try to write their dissertation as a book, but it's never that simple, partly because a dissertation is ultimately a document with an audience of 3 or 4 people, right? Your dissertation committee. And then a book ideally has a much wider audience than that. So the dissertation has to have a kind of scholarly apparatus and literature review in quite in depth, something in history we call historiography, kind of the history of history, looking at what scholars over, say, the past 50 years have said about this topic. That sort of has to be a key piece of the dissertation to show not only that you're versed in the what we call the primary sources, so the actual sources from the period, from the 18th century, but also what we call the secondary sources, what other historians and other writers have said about 18th century natural history, in my case. So I did have some present day components, but it wasn't really systematic in the dissertation. For example, I have this chapter on fish and the way that they would preserve fish specimens in the 18th century was quite odd. They're known as fish herbaria. So if you think of like a plant herbarium sheet where you take a flower and press it on a white sheet of paper, they would do that with fish. So they would cut a fish in half and take out the internal organs, take out the skeleton, and then they would press it on paper. And that was your specimen. It's not the gold standard for how it's done today. Although if we're looking at the very old specimens, those are the ones that have the longevity relative to the fluid specimens. So it's kind of in line with their thinking of nature as a second scripture at this time, as what they call the book of nature. And so I wanted to see if I could do this myself. And so I got some instructions from the 18th century on how to flatten a fish. And so I had a section in my dissertation that was about my process, making an 18th century style specimen. And one of my dissertation advisors, as a kind of offhanded comment, said, it would be so cool if you could do this for every animal in the book. But I definitely didn't have something in mind for rattlesnakes at that point. I didn't know what that would look like. And so it was a comment that just sort of stuck in the back of my head. And then when I was at Dartmouth, I got to thinking seriously about how I could pull that off.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to take a break and tell you guys that snakes are one of the most persecuted groups of animals in the world. But we are dedicated to changing that. The Orianne Society works every day to ensure there's a future for these amazing animals. If you care about snakes, wildlife or wild places, and you like what you've been hearing on the Snake Talk podcast, support us today by donating on our website at www.orian.org.
Let's move to talking about the snakes, but I want to do it kind of within that framework of the dissertation and the transition to the book, and you know, we'll certainly get into, you know, your stories about the, you know, visiting rattlesnakes in the field and all of that. But so to start off, you're at Harvard, you're working on, you know, your dissertation, obviously needs some form of a, you know, a plan approved by your committee. And how, you know, and you also, I should say, have this backdrop of being fascinated with snakes since a child, and you're putting together a dissertation topic, and you decide to use rattlesnakes as one of the example animals that you'll put into this framework. So I guess, what was it that made you choose rattlesnakes versus even another reptile or some other type of animal?
That's a great question. I chose rattlesnakes partly because they had been overdone, it seemed. There was so much out there about the history of rattlesnakes in the colonial period, whereas, you know, it's the time when we get all of this imagery, join or die, don't tread on me. There was all of this existing scholarship about the symbolism and iconography of rattlesnakes. And that's partly because people in the 18th century were losing their mind over rattlesnakes. So try to picture the scene where settlers in, let's say from England, are coming over to New England in the 17th and 18th centuries. And their worldview is that they are entering a wilderness. I should put that in scare quotes. It was not a wilderness. Native people had been sort of consciously managing these lands for centuries, but to them it was this kind of primeval biblical garden. And suddenly you have this serpent in the garden that can communicate with you, not with words, but with a rattle. It's, you know, there's a lot of parallels that they were drawing with the book of Genesis in the Bible. At the same time, many of these people who came over saw, as I had mentioned, nature as kind of a second scripture. It was God's handiwork. And so within this very providentially oriented worldview, everything in nature is supposed to have a purpose and it's supposed to have a meaning. And so what do you do with this snake there's a Puritan minister who calls them discommodities, rattlesnakes specifically, which is a nice turn of phrase, right? They're not really something you can turn into a commodity in the way you can with beavers or even raccoons. We can get to how they did find ways to commodify them. But so you have this seemingly useless, dangerous thing. At the same time, though, it comes with a built-in alarm system, right? And so they were fascinated to find that, you know, it was just another example to them of the wisdom and goodness of the creator, that this highly venomous snake can actually warn you of its whereabouts. So I wanted to talk about rattlesnakes because of their omnipresence in the history, also in the scholarship, and because even though there was so much writing about them, I felt like the story of the actual snakes had not been told. So there was so much emphasis on the revolutionary iconography that the snakes themselves had been lost. And that's partly due, I think, to the cryptic nature of rattlesnakes themselves.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that colonial history. You talked about the join or die or you know, don't tread on me type of flags that were used. Talk a little bit, just purely from a history perspective. You know, what are you talking about there? A lot of people will know, but many won't. Like, what is some of that history with rattlesnakes?
Yeah, so rattlesnakes came to be embraced as an icon of the colonies. There's an article that comes out that it's probably written by Benjamin Franklin. It's called An American Guesser, where the author sort of speculates on why rattlesnakes are a useful American symbol. So rattlesnakes don't have eyelids, so they don't blink. So there's this idea that they're constantly vigilant. There's this idea that they don't back down from a fight. They're strong and they're courageous. but they are a uniquely new world creature. And so that kind of is one of the main reasons. They're an astounding creature and they are unique to the Americas. So that makes them really apt as an American symbol. And so in 1754, during what the, you know, we learn in high school is the French and Indian War, but was kind of an American theater of what's called the Seven Years' War. Franklin publishes that iconic join or die image, the segmented snake, which at the time is a bid for colonial unity and then evolves into a revolutionary symbol later. That's one very famous piece of snake iconography that comes out of this era. And then the Continental Navy has the yellow and black Gadsden flag. And these are, I think, both icons that, you know, we see all the time nowadays too, whether that's the actual flags, bumper stickers, tattoos. What I find interesting too is that the strategies of representing snakes in both of these icons are actually natural history strategies. So how do you get something that's really long, like a snake, on a piece of paper as an illustration? You can either scrunch it up like the join or die imagery, or you can coil it like the Gadsden flag. So there's a lot of interplay between politics and science in this period too.
And so were those the primary kind of colonial time period, uses of, I'll just call it uses, it's the wrong word, but uses of rattlesnakes, either as icons, or are there other kind of major themes or items, anything of that nature that were kind of really important with rattlesnakes?
Those are the two big ones. The seal of the War Department also has a rattlesnake on it. So there is other kind of key American iconography containing rattlesnakes. That's maybe a lesser known one. I should also say that I think the antecedent to this iconography is Native Americans were also using rattlesnakes in a very similar way. So either, you know, drawing images of a rattlesnake on a tree to ward off enemies, or even tattooing themselves with rattlesnake imagery. The colonists are sort of borrowing or co-opting a strategy that had been in use long before they arrived. So you see it come up there, you know, if you go through kind of material culture collections from the mid to late 18th century, you see all sorts of rattlesnake iconography, but join or die and the Gadsden flag are the two famous ones.
You mentioned, you know, rattlesnakes as disc commodities. I know they weren't like true commodities in a sense. I know they were kind of hunted almost commercially at a point, but were those in those early days, colonial times, say, and I'd be interested to hear what you know about Native Americans as well. Were they using rattlesnakes for anything besides icons? Meaning, you know, were they using the meat? Were they using the venom? Were they using the bones, the hide, whatever it might be? Like, were there any kind of early utilitarian values either in colonial or Native American cultures?
Yeah, there absolutely were. So in colonial cultures and Native American cultures, they would, there are accounts of women sort of wearing rattlesnake skins during childbirth to help with delivery. Obviously in Native American cultures, you know, there's things like belts made from snake skin. Rattles were used in various forms of clothing or ornamentation. Sometimes they're sort of used in for kids for teething, just as coral was, which as a mother sort of, you know, I'm always thinking about choking hazards, but yeah, they get taken up in all of these interesting material culture ways, kind of daily use of artifacts. Within the scientific world too, they become very desirable curiosities, and sometimes money was exchanged to obtain either could be a live rattlesnake or a dead rattlesnake, not just because of the rattle, but because female rattlesnakes give birth to live young, they became a sort of reproductive curiosity. So there are accounts in London coffee houses and curiosity cabinets of, you know, come see this beautiful rattlesnake and her seven young ones that she just gave birth to. You can find ads in old newspapers. So they, again, because they wanted to make use of everything, partly, they did come to have all of these practical functions and entered trade in some ways as well.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that there was quite a bit known or had been done with rattlesnakes. There was so much, but that was part of what drove you to include them. But it sounds like you wanted to add to that historic knowledge. And so in the dissertation portion, before we get to kind of the contemporary in the book, what was there more to that story that you felt like, you know, through your research and everything that you added, you know, to our knowledge of rattlesnakes?
Yeah. One thing that really surprised me when I started reading the accounts, sort of looking, I was trying to look beyond just the symbolism and say, how were people sort of on the ground interacting with rattlesnakes? I was shocked as someone living in New England to learn how many rattlesnakes there were at the time. I don't think people walking around New Hampshire today are thinking about rattlesnakes all the time, but they really were in the 17th and 18th centuries. You still see landforms with names like Rattlesnake Mountain that shows that they were much more widespread than they are today, which is, it was very tragic, of course. And there really was a concerted campaign to extirpate them. So one really interesting thing I found that's relayed in a minister's writing, Cotton Mather was his name. He was a well-known Puritan minister. He talked about how in colonial Massachusetts, they would actually train the militia by having them go seek out rattlesnake dens in the spring, right as the snakes were coming out, and they would annihilate those dens, almost as a kind of precursor to rattlesnake roundups. So there are a lot of accounts of settlers exterminating probably entire dens of snakes. So that was something that really shocked me. And I was also really surprised to think about Native American relationships with rattlesnakes. And this is something, you know, many communities, even by this point, weren't producing written documents. So it's kind of filtered through these colonial sources and you have to read against the grain, so to speak. But certainly along the Eastern Seaboard, there is a pattern in many communities where Native people were trying to hide the whereabouts of snake dens from settlers to protect the animals. And it's a little more complicated than saying it's simply a kind of proto-environmentalist worldview. They sort of saw themselves as having mutual obligations to safeguard one another, Native societies and rattlesnake societies. And so they were kind of trying to avoid this retribution in some sense. But it's interesting because, as you know, herpetologists today often are keeping snake populations secret because people will still go out and either try to obtain snakes for the pet trade, or especially with rattlesnakes, I think, will still go out and kill snakes. And so that's actually something I was surprised to find, was that starts as a Native American practice.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know a lot of that, so that's fascinating. So let's move to, you know, so you're transitioning from the dissertation to the book, and you're adding some of the more contemporary components to the story, and so the first thing I want to do, and I'll kind of wrap these two questions up in one, is I want to, following the theme of the book, I'd like to hear just the high level, we'll dive in a little bit deeper, but like just your high level summary, like how did rattlesnakes shape our understanding of natural history, as opposed to thinking about the people who shaped our knowledge of rattlesnake natural history? So that's a high level question. And then I would love it if we could start off and get into your time in New Hampshire and the trip that you mentioned, and you wrote about it in your article, Den of Snakes, and maybe talk about that experience and how that shaped, you know, your thoughts around all of this. So,
yeah. So I'll take the first one first there in terms of how did the snakes themselves shape the course of natural history. Something you see in the writings of naturalists time and again is this question that I started with of fear of snakes. There was very much a belief that aversion to, fear of, hatred of snakes was natural and inborn within humanity. And it's, you know, people like Thomas Jefferson saying this even. And so there are certain naturalists, big names within the 18th century natural history community, people like Peter Collinson, people like Benjamin Smith Barton, who have difficulty studying and coming to know rattlesnakes because they are terrified of snakes. And so that reality, kind of paired with the cryptic nature of rattlesnakes, who are very, they sense the world very differently from us, right? They sort of see, so to speak, in infrared. They communicate and perceive their world through vibrations and pheromones. They spend most of the year underground. They are cryptic animals and have a kind of cryptic sociality too, which we might get into later. So that sort of base cryptic nature of the animal, paired with the very visceral human response to them, led to many aspects of rattlesnakes remaining unknown for a long time. And it also sort of chipped away at the notion that there's ever an objective observer of animals. We are entangled in a subjective way with these animals. One episode that I talk about in the book and in this accompanying article that I have in the William & Mary Quarterly is an account of a Pennsylvania man named Joseph Brightnall, who writes a letter, and it's published in the world's first scientific journal, the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. They were all published as letters at this time. And he talks about being bitten by a rattlesnake. And he tells, you know, the person he's writing the letter to, he says, you enjoin me a sad task. And he calls it the narrative of the fatal bite. Now, he doesn't actually die from the rattlesnake bite, but he does tragically, what we think happens is he probably commits suicide not long after this. It has a real lasting impact on him, and it begins to affect his dreams. And so you have in the world's first scientific journal, and really the kind of premier publication of the scientific world, an account of nightmares and a kind of dream journal. So it's rattlesnakes sort of forced naturalists to come to terms with the limits of their knowledge. And then to your second question about the present day portion of the rattlesnake story, I was in New Hampshire. This was when I was at Dartmouth, and had learned about this one remaining population of rattlesnakes, of timber rattlesnakes in the state of New Hampshire. So they're the most critically endangered animal in the state. And this is one of those sites that is kept very secret. Some people know where it is, of course. But you know, it's never a place I would disclose. I know we were talking before, and you have been there as well. And so I was really lucky to be able to go with a state wildlife biologist to see the den. We went in springtime, and the snakes had sort of beaten us to the punch, and they had already dispersed from the den. But we were able to find one female, and it was such a cool experience. This is a black morph population, so they're much darker than other timber rattlesnakes, which is part of also why people are eager to try to see them as a curiosity. But that curiosity can be dangerous to the snakes themselves. So I feel very privileged that I was able to get to see them.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to take a break to let you know that you can stay connected to the Oriane Society by signing up for our monthly newsletter. Be the first to receive exciting updates on reptile and amphibian conservation, from the latest news and staff blog posts to exclusive announcements like upcoming Snake Talk podcast guests. Go to our website at www.oriane.org and sign up for the newsletter at the bottom of our homepage.
So you're in New Hampshire at this time. You're at Dartmouth, and you are in the process of turning the dissertation, again, history, into incorporating kind of contemporary information. How did this trip, was this important in developing kind of contemporary information? How did it influence, that process going from dissertation to book?
Yeah, I think I was interested in highlighting that attenuated nature of rattlesnakes in New England and elsewhere today, and looking at the real crisis that these snakes are facing. I also, the timing just worked out that it was the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, right? We were out there in May 2020. And so I was not sure this trip would even happen. I was also pregnant at the time, so it was high risk in all sorts of ways, but the snakes are so endangered that was deemed essential state business at the time, because it was, this biologist, Brendan Clifford, it was his job to track these snakes and sort of monitor their health. And so the trip was allowed to proceed, but, going out as a pregnant woman to find this highly venomous, although very docile animal at what seemed like apocalyptic times. I mean, I think we all have memories of what lockdown was like and how weird life was in those months. It reinforced that idea of danger to me. My husband was really worried about this trip too. He was allowed to come since with social distancing. Brendan couldn't help me like scale the cliffside, for example. And then when we finally found the snake, we were sort of like, what were we so worried about? She was, just a sweetheart. And I never even saw her, the actual rattle. We didn't hear her rattle. We never got to see the appendage. So I've seen a rattlesnake in the wild, but I haven't seen a rattle.
I love the, I'm going back to the first part of your answering the question, but I love that concept that these fears and maybe myths that have developed over time around snakes actually hindered our knowledge of natural history. I also love, the second part of what we're just talking about now, I love that and how you wrote about it. And I would encourage everybody to read that article, Den of Snakes. But I love, you mentioned you're pregnant, and that's like this thread that winds its way through that story. You're pregnant. You're going out to see this gravid female rattlesnake in these apocalyptic times. Just it's a really great story. So, it sounds like it definitely impacted how you developed the book from the dissertation. What were some of the other more contemporary parts of timber rattlesnake, or we'll just say rattlesnake knowledge, that you were pulling together while in New Hampshire to again, complete the transition from dissertation to book?
Well, you mentioned gravid, and I think that's a really big piece of the story too, is the kind of, so I'll back up by saying, I think a lot of the emphasis on rattlesnakes has been on the iconography, as we've discussed, but there's been very little attention paid sort of in the colonial sources or in the present day, or more recent, I guess, historiography, less attention paid to the social worlds of these snakes. And actually, it's only been the past couple of decades that herpetologists have appreciated that rattlesnakes have these social community structures, that female sisters, for example, associate with each other long after birth, that the mothers stay with the young for a while. And so I wanted to get that sort of piece of the story out there too. Partly as kind of, rattlesnake PR, I think, because there's been so much attention paid to the fearsome risk aspects of rattlesnakes, it we forget that they're these family creatures in a way. And again, that's not to anthropomorphize, but just to say there's a lot more commonality maybe between us and snakes and other reptiles than we tend to appreciate. And I think that acknowledgement could be an important piece of helping people be more empathetic to snakes and lizards and tortoises, right? As you were talking about earlier, these aren't always people's favorite animals. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of misinformation about them. And so I thought by highlighting the kind of motherly side of rattlesnakes, even if it's a cold, scaly type of motherhood, alongside my own pregnancy, I could try to humanize them in a sense. And again, not anthropomorphically, but to show I felt like a snake too when I was pregnant, right? I was curled up and not moving much, and I could feel like I could empathize with those mother rattlesnakes.
Yeah. I give a lot of talks about rattlesnakes to all kinds of audiences, but to a lot of just general audiences. And that's always one thing that really surprises people when these like activities or feelings that we think about as humans, like being a mother or father and your child, and that something like a snake could even have anything remotely close to parental care. Even a lot of people who, even comparing them to other animals. And, you know, mm-hmm. So you'll hear at the end of the podcast when I close it out, one of the themes of this, what I'm doing in terms of outreach is that snakes are animals too. Meaning, like, I encounter a lot of people who think about, like, if they think about an elk in the Rocky Mountains, you know, they understand that elk, you know, they rut in, September, and they're bugling, and they migrate to a winter range, and they're giving birth at this time, and so on. They have this, you know, they have a biology to them. But a lot of people don't even realize, like, just think of snakes as these random things that were placed on the landscape. And so, anyways, it's interesting things like the parental care you're talking about that I think are really opening people's eyes. Some projects like the one you've probably seen in Colorado, and it's expanding where they have, you know, cameras on den sites. And we're just starting to see that, oh, again, snakes, there's real social activity going on there. And I think it's allowing us to get further and further from what we were talking about, even with the early naturalists, like having this fear and having that hold them back from understanding these animals. It's allowing us to better understand that. So, anyways, I will stop rambling. You're the one being interviewed, not me. But so what other, you talked about the, you know, kind of that parental care and the reproduction. Were there other kind of components that came into the book more in that contemporary category that kind of helped you explain how they, you know, how they influence our knowledge of natural history?
Yeah, just maybe one more thing I'll add that you made me think of right there was in terms of thinking of, you know, looking for maybe traits in snakes that we don't tend to associate with snakes, or we might associate more with mammals or birds, these more charismatic fauna. I was really surprised to learn how sort of home-centered rattlesnakes are, right? That they keep returning to this maternal den. And you have these generations of rattlesnakes and these dens that have been strongholds for a very, very long time. They are very home-centered animals. And I think that's just one more example of how we can see a lot of kind of affinities between ourselves and snakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. And to kind of along the themes we're talking about, the other thing I'll mention, you talk about the early naturalists, but I'll even bring it to contemporary times. I work in conservation and wildlife management. You know, I focus on snakes, but I work on many different species and work with a lot of people. There are many contemporary folks who would be, you would categorize as very extreme environmentalists who are dedicated to maybe not even conservation, more like preservation, who still are deathly afraid of snakes and almost still put snakes in a different category than almost all their plants and animals on the planet. So it still continues today, but I'm glad that times have changed. We've been going almost an hour. Let's kind of wrap up your story with, we got you to New Hampshire. We never brought you down to the South. How did you end up in North Carolina, where you're currently living? And what does the future hold for your work more generally and maybe more specifically relative to snakes?
Yeah, so maybe it's a more prosaic answer, but as much fun as we had in New Hampshire, we decided to move to warmer climes. And my mom, a number of years ago, had moved to the town where we live now in North Carolina. And having a young daughter, we decided to move near her to be near family and have our village. And it's been great. I love living here. I love the South. I love the people. I love the biodiversity. It's so cool to see all sorts of new animals. I've always dreamed of living somewhere where I could see lizards all the time. And I have a whole little army of guard lizards in this kind of stone that we have on the front of our place. So it's really fun to see the skinks and other creatures all the time. And so now I'm still affiliated with Dartmouth, but I'm also an independent scholar and really, again, working at this nexus of science journalism and the history of science and the history of natural history. So I have to be a little bit vague because it's not announced yet, but I am working on another project now that's about the past, present, and future of scientific collecting. And it's certainly not only about herpetology, but there will be some snakes. There's going to be some southern hognose snakes, maybe a mud snake, maybe some rough greens. I've done a bit of field work in the Carolina Sandhills, which, as you know, is this incredibly biodiverse region. So that's sort of all I can say right now. That's my little amuse-bouche, but there is more coming soon.
Great. Well, I will, along with where people can find the book, I will also provide a link in the show notes to your website where they can learn about these new projects as they develop. So before we close out here, as you know, I like to have all of my guests tell me a snake story. So what's your best snake story?
My snake stories are funny because I feel like as a non-herpetologist, other than the rattlesnake encounter and then those North Carolina snake encounters I teased, I don't have as many in-person rattlesnake stories. I did when I was, you know, potty training my daughter, we got this travel potty. And the first time we used it, I literally like set it on a snake. I don't know what kind of snake it was. It might've been like a Decay's brown snake. So a lot of my encounters with snakes are in the archives, actually. So the story I can conclude with is about a rattlesnake. I went to London's Natural History Museum a number of years ago, which, as you might know, used to be part of the British Museum. And the British Museum was founded with the collections of a naturalist named Sir Hans Sloane. So when he died, he bequeathed his collection to begin what is sometimes regarded as the world's first kind of modern public museum. And I was, you know, very interested to see, since it's an old institution, what kind of old specimens they had. So I met with the curator there, and he wasn't exactly sure. It's not how they catalog them by date of collection, or sometimes that metadata can be spotty, especially for really old specimens, but they had this handwritten ledger. And so I went to this book and I was just looking through and I saw the name Hans Sloane. And I got so excited because most of Sloane's animal specimens were actually burned in bonfires in the early 19th century, which sounds crazy and horrible to museum curators today. But, you know, as things were decaying, they were sometimes seen as a threat to existing collections. Deaccession has been a museum method for centuries. So very few of Sloan's animal specimens are known to exist. His herbarium, so his botanical specimens, that's really well preserved, but the animals, not so much. So I got really excited. We went down into the specimen stacks and we found a whole tier of very old specimens. And so we brought them up to the lab. And there was one in particular, and I call her 111-1A because that is her label number. This now bleached rattlesnake coiled in this massive jar. And she is actually the opening character of that rattlesnake section of my book and of this associated article that I have. And trying to put a kind of individual face to the history of this misunderstood animal. And so that is maybe a different snake story from one out in the field. But sometimes the field or the archive essentially is the field for the historian, right? We're often not out there in the weeds, but we're with all the paper and all the objects that are stored in libraries and museums. So that was definitely an experience to remember.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I'm assuming she was a timber rattlesnake.
Yes.
Yeah, great. Well, Whitney, thank you so much for spending time with me today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. And let's get out in the field and build your repertoire of field snake stories. So,
absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Okay, great. And I just wanted to thank the audience and tell everybody to remember, snakes are animals too. And it's a privilege to see one of the wild.